Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for this book club and interview. Today I'm going to be discussing the book Lawfare, A Practical Guide by Henry Martin, published by Imperium Press, that came out earlier this year. And to discuss it in depth today, I'm talking to its author, Henry Martin, otherwise known as Reactionary Reading Law. Thank you very much for joining us today, Henry.
Thank you for having me, Harry.
And so let's get straight into this then. So the book is called A Practical Guide. What was your reason for writing a practical guide that's kind of aimed at right-wingers and dissident centrist types? What is it that they do wrong that needed to be corrected with such a guide?
Right, so this ties back to the origins of my Substack, which I set up, 4 years ago now, 2021. The reason I set that up was I kept hearing people throw around the term lawfare with, especially in a UK context, with no understanding or deliberate use of the word, and they were just throwing it around. So whenever there was a judgment that our side of politics didn't like, it was activist judges, it was the result of left-wing lawfare and terrible, evil, liberal lawyers. And I'm caricaturing that position a bit, but that's been the quality of legal discourse on the right for years now, with the exception of myself and a few others now. And I decided that that had to change, and because a lot of the mistakes that were being made by people were fairly elementary mistakes that anyone with a basic understanding of law would be able to acknowledge as mistakes and work around. Moving on to the book, the reason I ended up writing the book was because lots of people in my sort of private life, people I know who are activists, content creators, and people like that, were saying to me, could you put a condensed understanding of lawfare, try and define the term and explain how it works in a practical context? So I spoke to my writing mentor and said, you've written lots of books, how do you do it? Step one was writing a proposal. So I had to think about it, wrote a proposal, and sent it to Imperium with links to my Substack. And myself and Mike had a conversation about it, and he said, I like the idea, get on with them. And yeah, I'm very grateful to Mike and Imperium for facilitating me writing this book. And moving on to what people get wrong, which I think was the second part of your question, because the American judicial system is often seen as the most similar judicial system to the British one, lots of people, and even relatively well-funded activist organizations, such as the SPUC and Christian Concerned, up until quite recently, had a very American attitude towards legal disputes and using the law in an activist way or activistic way. And the reason for that seems to be that there's the perception that the British legal system is a lot like the Americans, because it's an idea that comes from legal academia. And what's quite stark in legal academia with compared to practical law and people practicing law is most people who end up in legal academia have a very philosophical view of law, whereas if you discuss this with practicing lawyers, they have a very practical understanding, and there's not really a mixture between the two. So when a legal academic talks about law, they're primarily talking about principles without much of a consideration for practicality.
Yeah, I think from my own experience, looking at discourse revolving around this, and one of the interesting parts of the book is you set out very early on some of the most practical differences between the US and the UK legal system, which I was not entirely aware of myself. US law is seen as an outgrowth of historic Anglo-Saxon like legal traditions, at least when people discuss it in a rhetorical fashion. They're seen, I mean, America's entire legal system and their political system is kind of seen as an outgrowth of founding principles of the Magna Carta, this idea of Anglo-Saxon liberty. And so I think that's where people are coming from when they but treat it as though they are the same, when in fact, as you lay out through the book, they are very different from one another.
Yes, certainly with the practical aspects of how it functions, because the British judiciary as exists today isn't anywhere near as old as people think it is, in the sense that most of the way that the British courts worked, if you go back 500 years, would be unrecognisable to how it works now, because most courts were localised, and the way commercial disputes were dealt with was, it was a medieval form of arbitration. For those of you who don't know, arbitration is basically where you have a private judge who both parties appoint, who makes a legally binding decision. So for things like merchants' courts and commerce, legal matters, you had separate merchants' courts, which were mostly ran through the City of London. And other legal matters, depending on where you were in the country, would be dealt with by your lord, and then you would have the King's Justice, which, depending on what point in British history you're discussing or thinking about, the King's Justice may or may not have been in force because of war and difficulties with monarchy.
Yeah, and so when was it in that case that the modern conception of law, that, or at least the modern systems that we operate under in the UK, because obviously for the purposes of our own circumstances, I think it's best to focus on UK law through this interview. When was it that was set up?
Right, so it started in the 19th century and basically continued up until Blair. So prior to the mid-19th century, family court matters were dealt with by the church exclusively. Mm. So you had church courts that would deal with that, with marital disputes and enable divorces. And divorces, up until the middle of the 19th century, you had to go through Parliament for approval anyway. But it starts really in the 19th century, where you have a modern, well-unified form of justice in a way that would be recognisable today. I think that's a satisfactory answer to your question.
Okay, and I mean, you could say that the English legal system, since Blair, you mentioned Blair a moment ago, has tried to take on this veneer of the American system with things like the Supreme Court, at least, again, coming from a layman's perspective, which, as far as I can tell, do not have anywhere near the same kind of legislative or interpretive power that, say, the American Supreme Court does. If I'm getting anything wrong, you can correct me, by the way.
So on my Substack, there's an article called The Worst Things That Tony Blair Ever Did, and perhaps controversially...
Have you finished writing it? That must be a long one.
Oh, well, yeah, I finished writing it. I kept it mainly to fox hunting, but that's because I'm a country boy, so... With Blair, it was very controversial, the choosing of the name of the Supreme Court. The reasoning why the Supreme Court was established was because Blair was and still is a huge fan of separation of powers, and prior to the foundation of the Supreme Court, you had the Law Lords, which would be legally qualified lords who were exceptional lawyers in their own right. They would sit in the House of Lords, but they would also take on the most difficult appeal cases and provide binding judgments. The reason why Blair got rid of that was because that basically is a medieval system, or a remnant from the medieval era, wasn't conducive with his neoliberal ideas of separation of powers. So under Blair,
I'd imagine with somebody like Blair as well, it just didn't seem current.
No, it didn't seem current. So the role of the Lord Chancellor changed, and how a lot of the roles within Parliament and governance more broadly changed and became more separate. Whereas previously you would have had people who were appointed by the Crown in some cases and would serve different roles across government. So under Blair, the rules of how judges were appointed changed. So previously they'd be appointed by the Crown. After Blair, he established the Judicial Appointments Committee, which was, I mean, it was relatively similar to the Crown, apart from it was incredibly bureaucratic, because the Crown Appointments Committee, or the appointment of judges by the Crown, was, by the time Blair got rid of it, it was somewhat ceremonial, like giving assent to legislation. It's still a power the royalty have, in theory, to say no, but it hasn't been exercised in centuries.
Okay, and when we talk about all of this this stuff, and going back to the original question regarding sort of the way that dissidents talk about this, would you say that the kind of legal ignorance of all the sorts of subjects that you're covering there in rhetoric that's given, because through the book you are quite critical of some public figures,
yes,
of the way that they discuss legal matters. How would you say that that kind of hinders people's ability to make effective change? Because ultimately what we want as part of any dissident movement within Britain right now is for there to be effective change, effective blocks to changes being made to our towns and cities that we're not in favour of, such as, for instance, HMOs just coming in and airdropping a load of asylum seekers into your neighbourhood. Would you say that the kind of Americanized rhetoric is helping or hindering with that?
The Americanized rhetoric, I think, is a massive hindrance, and that's for a couple of reasons. Firstly, it doesn't get anywhere because it doesn't work. So I've got some examples that I've used on my Substack, and I believe I used them in the book. The most prominent of which, I wrote a case note on the Faircop case. That was years ago now. But Faircop, once the organization had been established, ended up achieving quite a lot. But that was because of political pressure, lobbying, and other productive political activities. The legal win in the Faircop case didn't achieve that much, other than saying that on a proportionality basis, the decision to investigate Harry Miller and give him a non-crime hate incident was disproportionate, and the advice given by the College of Policing was also unlawful on a proportionality basis. So when I say on a proportionality basis, what I mean is it's on a technicality and it doesn't lead to a significant change. That significant change has happened because of Harry Miller and Faircop's political activities, but the reason that investing in big legal cases is a bad idea is because it's expensive. I don't know off the top of my head how much was spent in the Harry Miller case, but it would have been tens, if not hundreds of thousands, because it went to a full judicial review. And there are other judicial reviews that got nowhere during the COVID period on regulations that were making the argument that the COVID regulations were disproportionate, unlawful, and irrational. And because people had hope that the court would do something to put a leash on the government during the COVID era, people were willing to spend money on legal cases, either their own or someone else's through crowdfunding, on legal cases that most lawyers would be able to tell you weren't likely to get where you wanted them to. And that's sad, because if people are raising hundreds of thousands of pounds, of millions of pounds to spend on legal cases that don't go anywhere, that money could be put somewhere else. And it's very sad for people who are hoping that legal cases will bring them some reprieve from government's oppression or other horrible things, because the needs of people and the wants of people not to be locked in their homes or not to have hundreds of thousands of migrants come in every year is a genuine need that people have. But it's, if you exercise the need or you put money into things that you want to work but you're not sure that they're going to work, you're doing a disservice, because you're just wasting money and people's time and attention. And in my experience, that's how people get genuinely disheartened. they
it end, can become demoralizing.
Yeah, demoralizing massively when people just waste money on things that aren't going to go anywhere.
Well, I mean, one thing that I've commented on, and this is, I think this could apply for the UK and the US as well, is the lack of strong patronage networks for dissidents, in terms of the fact that the left has always been overt in their support for their more radical elements. They Yes. never disavow their own more radical elements. There always seems to be some kind of money lifeline for these people, whether you're talking about in America something like the Innocence Project, which is literally crowdsourced money from celebrities to try and get cases thrown out from 20 years ago on the basis of like new bogus DNA findings, just so they can get criminals out. To when you talk about, you spoke about the lockdowns, you had the BLM riots, people being in and out of prison because there were organizations sponsored by people like Kim Kardashian to immediately pay for people's bail money. The right has no real equivalent to anything like that. I mean, you look at somewhere in like Australia where Joel Davis, who is a peaceful nationalist activist, gets arrested and put in prison for speech crimes, and there's no real funding lifeline that I'm aware of that's thrown out to him in a situation like that. And then to see this kind of big deal made over, like you say, what is essentially a technicality,
yes,
with loads of money spent on it, does seem like a quite demoralizing waste of time. And I dislike the way that people are so eager for whatever minor victory they can score, they'll cheer for scraps.
Yes.
They'll see something like, for instance, we're both friends with Scrump.
Yes.
Scrump has been quite vocal about the fact that the whole case that to do with the Tavistock Clinic.
Yes.
Ended up being celebrated as this huge win for the TERFs and other dissidents by saying that we finally got the Tavistock Clinic shut down. We're going to have the trans surgeries are going to finally go away. They've basically been outlawed, when actually when you looked into the reporting on it and the actual decision that had been made on it was something like, excuse me if I get any of the particular details wrong, that the care that they were being given at the Tavistock Clinic did not meet certain demands and requirements, and as such, they were actually expanding it into 6 to 8 more clinics. So in fact, those decisions ended up expanding the remit of that, of what the Tavistock Clinic was already doing.
Yeah, I remember reading the judgment on that case when I read it and thinking, oh my gosh, that level of legal ignorance of people reporting that, going on telly and celebrating that. It was quite clear to me that they hadn't bothered to read the judgment or ask anyone who could be trusted to give an accurate summary. And there are loads of examples like that in the book where I criticise the rhetoric of commentators and activists who clearly haven't read, or in the cases that they might have read something, understood something that they're celebrating, and they just don't understand that.
Well, I mean,
in fact, they've lost.
I mean, you even criticize, not necessarily criticize, but you try to give examples for us in Lotus Eaters of where we could have done something better than what we did in response to. You say here, I'll quote directly from the book, following the debut episode of the BBC Radio 4 podcast Mariana in Conspiracy Land, which alleged that Carl Benjamin had issued rape threats, Benjamin and his platform, the Lotus Eaters, opted to produce a rebuttal video. A more robust response would have involved seeking formal legal advice on defamation and rallying their considerable audience to file official complaints within the BBC and Ofcom. Had sufficient complaints been lodged and sustained, it's probable that Ofcom would have taken action against the BBC and the podcast presenter. So you are trying to
Yes.
present practical advice on how people can work within the British legal system, because one of the things that you point out a number of times is that there is both parliamentary sovereignty
Yes.
within the British system, which means that the judiciary actually are not as powerful as you would expect from all of the Americanized rhetoric surrounding it, but also that there's the public-private partnership that operates as well. And there are, within the more privatized systems, there are of regulation as well. There are official
Yes.
processes that you can take advantage of, which I found interesting given that I actually have worked for complaints before. It was for a phone insurance company. But I can only imagine the kind of headless chicken shenanigans that would have been going on if all at once multiple hundreds of the same complaints had come in at the same time. Because sometimes these complaints departments, even for larger companies, are not as big as you think that they are. And I can tell you from experience, I was on a team of 7 people, and it was for an entire phone insurance company, 7 people handling complaints. And of those 7 people, 4 were Jobsworths. Okay? And then there was me, there was one other decent one, and our manager. They were the only decent ones. I would often get complaints handed over to me that they would say, here's the decision that we've made, we'll throw it over to you, I'm not in today, can you just finish this for me? And I would be then responsible for making the call and saying, congratulations, we've accepted your complaint, you're legitimate in this, we're going to give you loads of money for it. And I would look over the work that had been done for the complaint and just found that the person who threw it over to me had just done as little as possible. They'd misread everything that had been given to them, almost like they just wanted to grant this person what they were asking for to get it over with quickly, and so they didn't have to have an argument over the phone, because that was a big concern for a lot of people. So one thing that you can leverage with the whole complaints processes is that if you're dealing with real people on the other side of them, there is a decently high chance that they might just give you what they want because they're lazy.
Yes.
Because they don't want to go through the hassle of doing their job properly. Like, I was the only one that actually did. And so on that subject, to try and lead all of that into a question, with the kind of examples that you're talking about, and with the example of, say, Harry Miller that you were discussing in Fair Cop, if you had been advising them on how to approach the case, what kind of advice would you have given them? What kind of advice would you give to normal people who think that they might have some kind of legal complaint or believe that they are being wrongly targeted? When, with parliamentary sovereignty, Parliament can kind of just pass any law that they want if they get enough votes.
Right, that's a hard question for me to answer because it's quite vague and also quite specific. But what I would say is some of the things that I've seen be quite effective behind the scenes is a case of, if you've been visited by the police for a tweet or something, it's generally quite a good idea to write an official complaint and make sure that it's well drafted. You include when you've got the complaint done and chase it up.
And who would you send that to?
Depends on the police force that it is, but if you go onto most police forces' website, there should be links to how to make official internal complaints and other relevant people, because normally what happens with organisations like the police, government departments, you have internal complaints which you go through so many levels of, and then you have the external complaints which will either be an ombudsman or someone else. And the thing is with making official complaints is you need to be specific and not rant at people. So if it's the case that you've been visited by the police for a tweet and it's clearly the tweet's clearly nothing illegal and there's no reason to complain, most people that I've seen do this successfully have complained on the grounds of harassment and also questioning why was the decision made to visit me for a tweet when there are other criminals who require police attention. And as a general rule, I think being somewhat involved in your local politics to whatever extent you can be is a huge benefit, because most police forces have a police and crime commissioner. They're another person who you can complain to about broader policy concerns. Because it's a similar role to a sheriff, but with less power, because sheriffs in the American context have considered more power than a British police and crime commissioner does. If it's the case that your local police force, even if you haven't been visited by the police, is spending a large amount of time visiting people for tweets and engaging in things that might be genuine criminal investigations, in the sense that it technically is a crime, but you can make public interest arguments and complain to them about why is there, I don't know, large-scale antisocial behaviour in my town when the police are investigating people for tweets.
So for instance, I mean, an example, a very recent example of something like this happening was Pete North.
Yes.
Being visited by the police. I believe it was off of the back of a tweet that he had posted regarding the Palestinian flag.
Yeah.
Insulting that. Is that the sort of thing that you would have advised him to do than make a big stink of it on Twitter?
Right, I'm not going to discuss the specifics of that because I don't know whether there's an ongoing investigation into it.
Oh, all right, okay.
So...
Oh, okay. That's absolutely fair in that case. And when we talk about this, so often we worry about the a situation within society that people have deemed anarcho-tyranny.
Yes.
And that you discuss within this book itself, and that is essentially the selective non-enforcement of laws, mm-hmm. so that you can create a situation where there's a two-tiered society and justice system where some people are having laws very heavily strictly applied to them, such as, for instance, over-policing of things like tweets, getting knocks on the door if you've put something that into the public that could be deemed offensive, versus people who are actually going and committing crimes and maybe the police are just ignoring it and looking the other way.
Yeah.
If you were to pursue the kind of tactics that you've suggested there, is that the kind of thing that there may be change? Are there any examples of people pursuing this?
Off the top of my head, no, because most of the things that I've described in the book are quite boring. So you can influence policing in your local area by trying to work with them and get on police advisory boards, because most police forces have advisory boards that advise on policy and also dealing with your police and crime commissioner. When I've seen it with people anecdotally trying to not pressure but try to reorientate the way their area's policed into policing properly, and it normally works best, as far as I've seen, with creating a dialogue with your police and crime commissioner and being very polite, but also making it clear that this is something you and other people care about, and you're not going to go away until that problem's been solved.
Mm. And through that you might be able to apply enough pressure.
Yeah,
I imagine that's the sort of thing where you would also want to organise locally a number of people to coordinate it.
Yes, because you can write to your police and crime commissioner on your own. It's a good idea, and I'd certainly suggest people, if they're not happy with the way their area is being policed, start with that, because complaints are generally meant for individual cases, not general policing issues. However, that's normally what the police and crime commissioner is for.
Yeah, and one thing in terms of that kind of like larger scale coordination and organization that you point out, I believe you do point out through the text of the book that the left have been much more effective in organizing in this way, and that is a big difference between the left and their radicals and dissidents, is that I don't know, it's a bit of a cliche for some people to say, well, people on the right tend to be more family orientated, they've got jobs and things that take up a lot of their time and energy, so they're not able to organize effectively in the same way. But with younger people these days, who are more disenfranchised, who maybe aren't as employed as they once were, for instance, I would say there is opportunity for organizing larger scale. It's just a case of people actually going and doing it.
Yes, I think that I agree with you there, but something I would add is taking part in your local anti-HMO group is not going to take up too much of your time. It might involve you going to meetings and being present at a meeting, saying or writing a formal objection to planning permission, but generally if you've got a HMO group with a couple of hundred people in it that's organized through Facebook, it's probably going to take up at most a couple of hours a week. It's not going to be something that is going to take up all your life or a large portion of your life for the next 10 years.
Yeah, I think that's actually a very positive way of looking about it, because people don't want to put themselves on the line, so to speak, and perhaps what they may consider take so much time away from themselves and their families, purely for the sake of something that may not that they don't know that they have a guaranteed result from. But this is the sort of stuff that takes time.
Yes.
You've got to have the time investment, and the idea that people can just go and do this, I think is positive and encouraging. But one of the other things that you talk about, you have a chapter on character destruction.
Yes.
And the risks that come with putting yourself into a public space where sleazy media tactics will try to smear you.
Yeah.
They will try to make you seem like somebody who, like, they'll dig into your entire background. They will, I mean, we saw with a segment I was talking about earlier on today with Piers Morgan, like, newspapers have been known to illegally hack into people's devices for the sake of trying to get juicy information from you. And even with somebody like
Harry Shookman.
Harry Shookman. With the case of Harry Shookman, some of these organizations like Hope Not Hate seem to have very strange access to facilities that we as normal people would not, even though they've now come out and addressed it and said that he legally changed his name, seemingly for the sake of procuring a passport. But also there was the case of Raw Egg Nationalist last year being doxxed, and they released newspaper articles about all of the incredibly in-depth methods that they went through to be able to get his personal information, when it's more than likely that he was in fact just, like, potentially, it seems more likely that there were some illicit methods of getting that information, possibly in conjunction with other organizations.
I wouldn't be surprised to find out if MI5 or other intelligence organizations and parts of the British deep state were actively involved in giving Harry Shookman the documents and helping him infiltrate some of the groups that he did. I mean, infiltrate is probably the wrong word, because he infiltrated Basket Weavers, which...
He was at the Witten as
yes.
well, wasn't he?
I
believe we were both at as
yes,
well.
We
so
were.
It's weird that we were both in the same building as him at the same time.
Yes. Well, and he just went to the pub with a couple of people and wrote a book about, basically, these people go to the pub and are far right. And all they're dangerous. And
here are the things that they talk about after a couple of pints.
Yeah.
I mean, this was pressing and necessary for the intelligence state to get out to the public. Mm. So for the sake of headlines, essentially, for the sake of smearing headlines.
Yeah. And to be honest, I think with a lot of because I've organized events and done that type of thing before, I've met quite a lot of undercover journalists, and they're really easy to spot. Because I don't think I had the displeasure of meeting Harry Shookman, but everyone I know who did said, oh, he was really awkward. Whenever you'd ask him questions, he'd give one-word answers or turn the question back on you. And then he'd just listen to the conversation. Because when I've organised events and I've had undercover journalists turn up, all right, you be nice to them, you ask them some questions and just try and talk to them, and they're impossible to talk to. They'll throw questions back at you, and you're just like, I'm sorry, but if I've asked you a fairly basic question and for your opinion on something, and you can't give me a straight answer, that's normally a sign that you don't belong here. And if you do have undercover journalists turn up at your events, I don't see why you can be anything but gracious towards them. Because these people, other than the fact that they're going to smear you, they're not that dangerous, and they're really unimpressive people.
Well, I mean, I can only imagine that they're just so out of their depth.
Yes.
Especially showing up at somewhere like the Witten.
Yeah.
That he's no idea of the context of anything that anybody's saying. There's so much esoteric internet talk going on that, yeah, it is easy. Although there is also the difficulty of, are you a Fed or are you just a Spurg? But we were talking before we started recording about the importance of gatekeeping.
Yes.
And gatekeeping the movements. And I think that's something that's important when we're talking about larger scale organizations. Organizations have begun to spring up around influential figures like Rupert Lowe and his organization Restore Britain. Would you say that gatekeeping is just as simple as giving the sniff test if this guy seems like a Feddy Spurg?
No, it's not. It depends what you're doing. If it's something like Basket Weavers and it's literally just people going to the pub, maybe organising a walk or a hike or going to do an activity like climbing, there's no need to have any higher level due diligence done on people, because you can just get rid of people who annoy you and misbehave. And
I've seen it happen plenty of times.
The misbehaving isn't really going to cause you an issue, or certainly not long term. The problem then becomes when you're doing genuine political action or something like that, or getting money off people, giving people money. That's when you need to start having some serious conversations about due diligence. I mean, would you like a practical example of some things that I've seen go on in the sort of wider political scene?
Absolutely, please.
Okay, right. So there was this guy a couple of months ago who was floating around the London political scene. His name was Norman McKenzie, or the name he used was Norman McKenzie.
And this was somebody floating around people that
we both know. And the way that he presented himself to me was he presented himself to me as the director of an organization called Ofcom Watch. You won't have heard of this organization because it basically doesn't exist.
I'm just giving it a quick Google. Okay. It seems to be a single Twitter account with less than 6,000 followers.
Yes, exactly.
Hmm.
So when you set up organizations and campaigns, there's normally going to be a paper trail, if you will, on those type of organizations. It'll be registered and there'll be websites and people involved in the organization and things like that.
If they're fully registered, there'll be a government website that you can go and find.
Yes. This guy was floating around the scene saying things like, oh, he's Rupert Lowe's chief of staff, and things that are quite easy to falsify. And in my case, I did, and didn't have anything to do with him after I checked. But the problem is, what he was an expert con man. And this man, Norman McKenzie, when you look him up, there's a website that I believe was released a couple of months ago that displayed him, that had been taken control of by his debtors, naming him as a serial fraudster.
All right.
Unfortunately, this man ended up conning quite a lot of people out of money. And from what I could tell by talking to him in the early conversations I had with him, he was trying to set up an organization, and it seemed to me like he was going to crowdfund his Ofcom watch and then run off with the money. And there are examples of that happening with other political organizations. Fortunately, it's not ridiculous amounts of money, but you do get people who turn up in media spheres, in political spheres, who are con artists or people who are so incompetent that you wouldn't want to give them money. And Norman is the perfect example, because if you'd have done some basic professional level due diligence on him, you would have found that out. But the problem with having that as an expectation from people is you need people like myself, like others who have the skills and know-how to do professional level due diligence on someone, and then you also need to be able to convince other people that you're not making trouble by excluding that person from particular organizations. So it's something that, as far as I've noticed, this is one of the biggest problems that I see going forward with the right-wing media space and political space. There's no formal gatekeeping mechanism where there should be, especially if people are asking for money or obtaining free services of people, because what that does, having con merchants who are quite good at this, actually,
From what you describe, it doesn't even sound like he had a particular political agenda. It was just he was trying to get the money.
Yeah.
And this was a circle of people who, because of the fact that we're somewhat out in the wilderness.
We trust people.
We're in dissident spheres. There's an eagerness to want to accept people in who seem to... there's an overt trustingness, which you would expect to be the opposite, but it's actually people are too trusting because they're eager to get more people in on it, especially if they seem like they can help with patronage.
Yes. It's the amount of people I meet in the right-wing political media spheres who... A big problem I've noticed is lots of people who end up in the media or politics don't have that much life experience. Even the ones who are in distant spheres, they've normally got some other psychological issues, and they just don't have the experience to be able to tell when someone's trying to con them. And a lot of the people in the broader scene, whether it's distant art especially, you have quite a lot of people who can be described as nepo babies who are quite vulnerable to being conned or getting themselves into trouble with people because they don't have the experience and they're not naturally suspicious because they're very well sheltered and have been.
Yeah, and this is, I would say this even expands just purely outside of the purely financial realm as well. This can just be political grifters.
Yes.
Who are looking to attach themselves to a scene so that they can gain a bit of notoriety and then hop from one movement to another. And this is the other problem with gatekeeping. If you are so eager for people to join your movement, you can end up ratcheting your own views to match theirs rather than bringing them into your own views. And so I find that people tend to dilute and weaken their own spaces if they do not gatekeep well enough.
This is an ongoing argument that I have a lot about gatekeeping, because I'm very in favour of not having anything to do with people like Tommy Robinson, who there's enough evidence out there, whether it's the allegations that Lauren Southern has made, which people can look at those in their own time, or it's his track record, that Tommy Robinson is not worth working with because he seems to have, and it's been alleged, he has quite a lot of personal issues, whether that's drug usage or financial problems.
I mean, I've been critical of him simply because he tends to draw all movements that he gets involved with into an orbit so that they orbit him.
Yes.
Purely, he turns every movement he's involved in into purely being about him, which I suppose if you purely want eyes on your movement in the media, then that can then you're going to get eyes.
Yeah.
But whether you're going to get effective change off of the back of that, and you are you're critical of Tommy in this book, and you're critical of the idea of having these overwhelming media figureheads in the first place to a certain extent.
Yeah, the reason for that is someone like Tommy, but also Nigel Farage and Tommy Robinson, in the aspect that they're big characters and the way that their political organisations work round them, they're very similar in that aspect. I'm sure neither of them would appreciate the comparison, but the issue with that is most people who are large characters aren't people who you can trust to do the day-to-day things and do useful political activism. Normally those people need to be kept on a leash, actually, and controlled and kept in their lane so that they don't cause problems for other people, but also they can be useful to the movement more broadly.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, is that I don't think it's necessarily a good idea to eschew those kinds of figures altogether, because it is good to have media outreach for everything. And one of the interesting solutions that you suggested in this was to almost have people set up as fall guys.
Yes.
Because the media, you talk about Tory sleaze.
Yes.
Being the thing that took down many Tory governments, because they have always, for whatever reason, they've seemed to be the party of sex scandals and affairs for a very long time. Very strange that it would be the Tories. They do seem at this point to just frankly be a casual gay club.
And a very pro-Israel club.
All of the parties are.
Yeah, well, with the Tory party, it seems like there's two factions that exist. You've got the gay side of it, and then you've got the really pro-Israel side of it, and they seem to be like two different factions.
I've not considered the Tory party in that divide, but that's interesting. But yeah, you talk about this Tory sleaze. If you have somebody like Tommy Robinson who can have lots of allegations thrown against him by other media officials, I mean, Trump managed to sidestep a lot of it quite effectively just through his sheer media presence.
Yes.
Through his ability to dodge questions or reorient questions around you. You name some examples of where he does it, where he did it in the lead up to the 2016 election. But this idea of the fall guy, that's going to be somebody who's either going to have to be media savvy and adept like Trump to be able to get around these things and to be able, I think it was the quote you give is when he was asked, you compared women to pigs, and he said, no, just Rosie O'Donnell. Well, you can turn it around on them and turn it into a joke and it can make you seem more charming. Or somebody who is willing to take the fall. But for that, they are probably going to need some security. They're going to need an incentive to want to put themselves at risk like that, because these are risky positions people put themselves in. But you also need, if you're going to go to those lengths, you need to have an actual effective and practical organization behind them.
Yes. What I've noticed with basically media figures is normally the media figures need to do their media thing and they can't do anything else really. I mean, some of them might have some talents, but what I've noticed with, whether it's someone like Lawrence Fox or whether it's someone like even, actually, no, I'm not going to use this example, but someone like Lawrence Fox, for example, is very good at the media stuff. People find him entertaining. But he's been given ridiculous amounts of money by people to set up things that he's not qualified to set up or run. For example, he's got something called the Bad Law Project, which is meant to be a legal NGO that protects people and helps support people who are under oppression by the state, whether it's people who have political views or whether it's people who are for some reason being oppressed by the government. I don't understand why it was ever a decision to give Lawrence Fox money to fund something like that. Because, okay, if he wants,
he's a strange person to have at the head of that.
And I think the reason why it took so long for there to be people who are openly out and out lawyers in the scene of the right of centre is, first of all, generally conservative lawyers are generally quite conservative in that they don't think they should have any involvement or discussion about politics, which is fair enough. But also, lots of legal avenues and legal organisations that are associated with the right have got quite dodgy track histories of engaging in some quite, not necessarily illegal, but doing things that makes people involved with them look bad. So you've got the cancellation risk, but you've also got the risk if you're a lawyer who wants to do some volunteering or wants to take some work from a right-wing legal organization like the Bad Law Project, is, am I going to be associated with someone who is going to make me look bad because they're not qualified to be doing what they're doing? And on that example specifically, with Lawrence Fox, he had a falling out with the Free Speech Union relatively recently because he was encouraging people, or the Free Speech Union claimed he was, encouraging people to vandalise ULEZ cameras. And it's like, I'm speaking for myself, I don't want to be associated with people who are either my boss or even as an ambassador for an organisation who are going to run their mouth and do stupid things in a way that is childish and is going to make me look bad. I don't mind being
associated. Well, I mean, if you're encouraging vandalism, you're just trying to tell people, put yourself at the risk of going to prison.
Yes. I mean, that's a crime. Like, encouraging vandalism is a crime. And that's what the Free Speech Union said. And that's how they dealt with it. But it's, when I started to get involved in the scene practically, I basically got a name for being the boring person, the moral enforcer, if you will, because I don't tolerate bad behaviour, and you shouldn't tolerate bad behaviour. I mean, if it's in private, fine, but if you're a public figure and you behave badly in public, like people like Lawrence Fox do, you're poisoning the well for other people.
Yeah, I think people take the wrong lessons from what they see the left getting away with.
Yes.
You can have, I know you don't really know who he is, but you can have like a Hassan Piker, who's going to make outrageous statements and say things like America deserved 9/11, who can do things on Twitch like be caught what looks like electric shocking his dog to stay in place over and over and over again so that it can act as a prop for him while he's streaming in the background. You can have psychos like that because he's on the side that's in power.
Yes.
These people have the overwhelming cultural support behind them already. The people are willing to make excuses for him and people are willing to pay him for the propagandistic services that he provides. You can't really afford that when you're not in power.
No, you can't. Because a general observation I have of free speech law in the UK is that it can protect the diversity of views, but it will not protect the way though a diversity of the way those views are expressed. So what I mean by that is that if you are a leftist, someone on the left, you can pretty much get away with saying whatever you want, however you want to do. Well, that's been what's the norm up until fairly recently. The exception is the anti-Israel stuff. For example, lots of people on the left who had previously been allowed to get away with rhetoric that they're now no longer getting away with have found that out. But a lot of people who have been cancelled and successfully recovered from it in the UK who are on the right or avoided being cancelled, they've done so because they're relatively boring in the way they express their views and they're not bombastic. They exert opinions clearly and concisely.
They're not trying to be shock jocks.
They're not trying to be shock jocks. No, and this is why I think someone like Charlie Downs does so well, because he's, I wouldn't say he's far right, he's a sensible centrist, but he goes to places in a polite, well-spoken manner in a way that other people just don't. I mean, he references Carlyle on GB News, but he does it in a very polite way, and his personality is very amenable to lots of other people, like boomers like him. So it's very hard to call someone like Charlie Downs racist and try and take them down, do a character assassination, and because he's a reasonable guy. He looks reasonable, he talks reasonably, and he's also very polite.
And yeah, I mean, we've had him on the show a number of times. Yes. I know Charlie personally. He's a very well-behaved and very polite young man. As far as I'm aware, he's not the kind of guy that you hear rumours about circulating behind the scenes that could be used as compromat later. No. He's very on the ball, and he sticks to his lane in the best way possible. He is the professional media face. And it's interesting when you bring up the way that free speech provisions can work within the UK, because one of the most interesting examples that you give here, which I think illustrates this perfectly, is in cases of people having been prosecuted for Holocaust denial or revisionism, in that what people may not know is the cases that have been prosecuted in the UK have been when it's been overtly intended to offend people through mediums like cheeky offensive songs and video content, despite the fact that actually it's not, unlike many European countries, it's not illegal on the face of it to have those views and even to publish those views. And in fact, within the UK there have been a number of professional scholarly, you say in here, works published on those subjects that they're allowed to do.
Yeah.
And it's simply the format. And I think by going to such an extreme example that most people, even some so-called free speech warriors, may disagree with, actually goes to show your example quite well by saying that, well, I mean, this is like most people wouldn't even dare talk about this with their closest family members at the dinner table. And yet, as long as you're presenting it in an inoffensive manner, in a boring manner,
yes,
it's actually legal to do here.
Mostly.
Mostly.
Yes. There are some exceptions. So you can't just encourage violence on someone else, even if it's done very boringly.
Well, obviously outside of like incitement.
Yes.
And things that have their own provisions to them. Sorry.
Yeah, because what I found interesting about things like incitement to racial hatred, when I wrote the book originally, incitement to racial hatred was very rarely used for prosecuting people. And since the Sam Miller case, it's become considerably more common, especially after Southport. But even Lucy Colney, I'm quite unpopular with my position on Lucy Colney, in that I don't think the decision was unreasonable, given that from the court documents, she did directly incite violence. It may be the case that it was a joke and she didn't actually mean it, but given the circumstances and the evidence that is discussed in the court documents in the trial, I don't think it was unreasonable for her to be given the sentence that she had. However, what I will say is I don't think it was unreasonable for the judge's decision and the court's decision, because going back to the topic of judges and the difference between the American and the British judiciary, I got into an argument with someone on Twitter earlier, what was it, yesterday, basically making the point that it's not the judge's fault that people are being given longer sentences for what are broadly called speech crime than people who have been caught in possession of child pornography. The reason that happens is because of sentencing guidelines and legislation. It might be true that there are some judges who aren't independent and are fifth columnists. I haven't seen that much evidence of that. I mean, I've seen the examples where some judges have been on the board for left-wing charities, and in my opinion, those judges shouldn't be sitting in cases where the facts of the case relate to those given previous experience or previous roles that they've had. But in general, from the judges I know, most of them are quite reasonable people. Like, so, they're not ideologues.
So with it being down in many cases, like you say, to the sentencing guidelines within the UK, because I mean, just recently we've had the transcripts released of a lot of the grooming gang cases.
Yeah.
And I've been reading through them, and they, whenever they're going to the sentencing, telling them how what they're actually going to be, how long they're going to be in prison for, they're always going for the sentencing guidelines and laying out the specific distinctions. The crimes were committed then when there were different laws in place, but we're going to go by the sentencing guidelines for how long you could be in prison for them then, although we're looking at the laws as they exist now, et cetera, et cetera. Who is in control of the sentencing guidelines? And if you wanted to make it so that, for instance, I think many people would morally agree that incitement to racial hatred, if you even consider that to be a legitimate category, should not be sentenced to the same degree as child pornography. How, like, who's in control of that? Is there a practical way for people to affect change, or is that going to have to be political?
That's going to have to be political.
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to deal with that through any form of legal leverage. You would basically have to have someone like Rupert Lowe as Prime Minister, because the Sentencing Council is a quasi-autonomous body, a quango, but it's held at an arm's length from the Ministry of Justice. So you would need to be in power to address the sentencing guidelines. You've also got the problem that many crimes that are crimes by statute have statutory limits on the sentence that can be given.
All right.
So it's not as simple as going, yes, I'm now in power, therefore we're just going to change the sentencing guidelines. You could change some of them. You could change quite a few of them, but you'd need to understand how the sentencing guidelines at present intersect with primary legislation and case law.
All right.
So if there's certain case law that makes it the norm for a crime to be punished by X sentence, then because of the way the hierarchy of government powers works, generally common law is held has greater power over than other forms of secondary legislation. But you can change common law or case law with primary legislation, but generally it's accepted that case law from the courts is superior and can't really be overruled by government ministers.
Okay.
Sorry, does that make sense? Because that was a bit waffly.
So let me just try and collect what you said there. So the actual sentencing seems to be at least partially administered by something that's held at arm's length from the government. And
sentencing council.
The sentencing council. And if the judges are looking at case law, that can override political decisions by the MPs.
Right. So when we say political decisions, what are you on about?
Because for instance, we've been talking about, you mentioned Rupert Lowe. One of the things that you've written about recently was his large document talking about the potential of mass deportations, something that Charlie Downs has spoken about and Harrison Pitt has spoken about as well, would be the necessity of what they have called, alongside the Great Repeal Bill, if people were to get into power, would also be something called the Great Clarification Bill, something that would clarify particular terms, possibly legally, as well. Would that be something that would be effective, or would they need to affect a different change?
If it's defining, if you want Parliament to just define what certain words mean in a legal context, then from my understanding of what you said, Parliament could just narrow the definition of particular legal terms. That is certainly doable.
Mm-hmm.
But the concern I've got with the Great Clarification Bill is I don't know too much about it, and whenever
I've only ever heard it as something mentioned in passing alongside the idea of the Great Repeal Bill, which I think was a David Starkey idea.
So I don't really want to comment too much on the Great Clarification Bill because I'm not best placed to understand it.
That's fair. So we've spoken a lot about, in that case, let's go on to, I've mentioned Restore.
Yes.
And your article that you wrote about them. We've spoken a lot about how some of the political organisation and the political media figures within the UK can be counterproductive and they can be harmful to the movement. And you've praised Charlie Downs for being a very, not milquetoast, but very acceptable media figure.
Yes, he's not milquetoast by any means of the imagination.
No,
he references Carlyle on GB News and talks about Carlyle.
Talks about Sam Francis, anarcho-tyranny. Yeah. He's a big fan of a lot of authors that most people in the media spheres would never have heard of, let alone read the works of. But with Restore Britain, do you see any hope coming from them with their plans for the mass deportations and the laws that they would affect for that? You have written an article on your Substack, which people can access if they want greater clarity with all of your thoughts. But do you see that as a positive step?
Right. The short answer for Restore Britain is a cautious yes. I like the idea of Restore Britain. I really like the idea that you have a team of bright young men and women who are being led by someone mature like Rupert Lowe, who are putting their heads together and thinking about policy. In principle, it's a good idea. And I have made some that I hope are constructive criticisms of Restore Britain. One of the concerns that I have discussed in private has been, it seems like a lot of the staff of Restore Britain are people who are media people and not necessarily policy people, and don't necessarily have the legal or policy background to draft well-written policy and legislation. This is something that some of the lawyers who I speak to quite a lot, who read my Substack, have mentioned to me. And I am aware that they have the black belt barrister on board as an advisor in some capacity or another. And
I mean, you would hope that there would be some kind of legal expertise advising them if they're going to be proposing massive legislation changes.
You would hope. At present, I don't think it's there yet to be able to do what I would like it to do. However, that's not a bad thing. It's only been set up for a year, less than a year.
I think it must only be
a couple of months.
6 months, maybe.
6 months, maybe.
Because, I mean, Rupert Lowe was only kicked out of Reform at the beginning of this year.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So it's in its infancy. And any criticisms that I'm about to make of the report or any other criticisms that I've made, will be caveated in that it is early days. Putting the concerns of the media presence of a lot of the Restore Britain people aside, I'm also a bit concerned that the criticisms that I made of the Restore Britain report into mass deportations were twofold. First of all, I think it focuses too much on the ECHR, and the reason that's a concern for me is in popular dialogue in the media, the ECHR is always discussed as an obstacle to having more sensible restrictions on things like refugee and asylum and enabling deportations of criminals.
I was actually going to ask about the ECHR, whether it's more of a political media football to get headlines rather than something that's actually as important as it's made out to be.
Yes. It's nowhere near as important as it's made out to be. And in the book, and in the article as well, I go through some examples of and give a detailed legal explanation as to why the ECHR isn't the primary issue stopping things like mass deportations. And
so I mean, on a video that we did a while back now, Carl decided to depress me by showing me a number of cases where there was a prosecution put forward to some asylum seeker who'd done something horrible like rape somebody, and instead of deporting them, the ECHR had been cited as whichever the human right is, right to a family life,
yes.
For instance, was one that was consistently brought up. Is that something that our judiciary and political system, if we decided to, could just sweep aside and ignore?
Yeah.
We could just dismiss.
Yeah, could just do that. So in terms of the ECHR specifically, the Human Rights Act gives the ECHR specific powers in British legislation. So what's happened over the past 20 or so years, there's been a range of cases that have evolved and interpreted working alongside primary legislation coming from Parliament to create the current system for dealing with asylum claims and deporting foreign criminals. You'd need Parliament to do it, but you could just change the rules in terms of refugee status using Parliament. It's not something that we need to have an elaborate Brexit process about. So I want to make myself clear. I'm not saying that the Prime Minister can just randomly decide to ignore the ECHR.
Mm.
What I'm saying is Parliament, if it wanted to, could just change the law on asylum and on immigration and make it clear in the legislation that this supersedes the ECHR. So I'm not really for getting rid of the ECHR or leaving it, because I just don't see the point.
It would be a lot of use of time and energy,
yes,
that could be done much more simply. Like what you're describing there, Boris Johnson could have done at any point,
yeah,
if they were serious about actually changing asylum law.
Yeah.
And it's just another case, another example of Boris Johnson and his government just betraying us.
Yes.
As far as I'm concerned. But sorry, carry on with what you were discussing with the Restore Britain. You had gotten on to their focus on the ECHR.
Okay.
How that was maybe not as important as what they could be focusing on.
I really like the primary legislation. I was a bit concerned that the Modern Slavery Act wasn't mentioned.
Mm.
Which, the thing is with the Modern Slavery Act, I found it quite difficult to... I wrote an article on it, but I found it quite difficult to find statistics on how many people have been allowed to stay using the Modern Slavery Act, and how many of those people end up with indefinite leave to remain. So I put a Freedom of Information request on that topic, which I'll write up when I get it back.
That's currently pending.
Yeah, it's currently pending.
And the Modern Slavery Act, that's if you have been trafficked into the country.
Yes.
Do you automatically get granted refugee status?
No. You are given the right to remain on the grounds of criminal investigations that you're part of, support and help, and... I can go into more detail.
So it could be a case that these people who get off the boats, even if they've chosen to pay for it, they could just get here and claim, oh, I was trafficked over here.
From the way the human trafficking is defined under the Modern Slavery Act of 2015, I would find it very hard to see an example of someone who has entered the UK illegally who wouldn't be awarded the protections of the Modern Slavery Act. So
that definitely needs to be addressed.
Yeah, that does need to be addressed. Even if it's not a huge problem with tens of thousands of people being allowed to stay in the UK under it, it's something that potentially could be used by human traffickers and people posing as asylum seekers. And in that article, I do discuss the point that it is a problem. It might seem like the compassionate thing to do to let someone who's a victim of modern slavery or human trafficking stay in the country. But if they are allowed to work in the country and are given asylum or are given indefinite leave to remain, that person who is seen as an asset by human traffickers will then be able to send the human traffickers money. Because the way that modern human trafficking works is you've got this whole global network of people smugglers who smuggle people, in some cases against their wills. Sometimes it works by a loan system where if you default on the loans that you're meant to be paying back, it can be arranged that someone in your family gets hurt. So allowing these people to stay and giving them the right to work or giving them benefits and support can actually be counterproductive and continue to monetize an industry that is, I think last time I checked, human trafficking and modern slavery as a criminal network is worth more every year than the drugs trade.
So what you're actually, the argument you're making there is that even on its own terms for what it's setting out to do, this legislation could enable more abuse.
Yes. And I think there's loads of bits of legislation like that in the British system that needs to be updated for a global environment whereby our compassion is seen as weakness, and by allowing people to take advantage of our compassion, we're enabling greater evils. But circling back round to the Restore, I genuinely think Restore Britain is doing well, and the other concern that I've got with the report is especially the hostile environment section. That wasn't particularly well thought out. I think that, right, for those who aren't aware and haven't read it, there is about half the report is on the logistics of mass deportations. And what they discuss is they discuss creating a hostile environment for people who are in the country illegally.
Mm-hmm.
And they go through all these policy suggestions that are great, but they're not particularly well thought out. For example, one that stuck out to me and I discussed in the report is working with local councils and community care workers and other responsible adults to identify people who are in the country legally. The reason I suggest that policy suggestions like that aren't well thought out is I don't see how that's going to interact with other legal obligations that responsible adults have, and care workers, and basically anyone else you can name who is in a position of authority and responsibility over vulnerable people, how that's going to interact with the care duties those people have and the obligation to report illegal immigrants. And there are lots of examples like that in the Restore Britain report where it's a good idea, but it hasn't been particularly well thought out.
So what there would need to be in situations like that, would there also need to be adjustments of how all of these other responsibilities interact with one another?
Yes, you'd basically need a report on how to implement a policy whereby people who are responsible for vulnerable people are to interact with immigration officers and report people who are in the country illegally. That would be a whole policy paper in of itself. And I think with the report that Restore Britain came out with, they're trying to run before they can walk. I think what would have been a really good use of time was a really thorough explanation of getting rid of and adjusting for creating new domestic legislation to enable mass deportations.
Yeah, and with that, a lot of people talk about the idea of self-deportation that people would want to have, not necessarily the hostile environment that was suggested there, but for instance, just like to not encourage people to come over to take advantage of the benefit system and such like that. Would it be more worthwhile right now to try and come up with legislation? Because I also think that it comes across less hostile.
Yes.
By not having it be deportations, but just incremental changes to the way the benefit system incentivizes people to come over and claim our taxpayer money for themselves. Yeah. Would it be a worthwhile for an organization like Restore Britain to focus on policy proposals in that direction as well?
I would say so, yes, because the problem you've got is that an organization like Restore Britain, as far as I know, they have fairly limited resources.
Mm-hmm.
And dealing with and generating the policy suggestions that you've suggested as relates to the benefit system would take quite a lot of time and expertise, because the benefit system is extremely complicated.
Yes.
And in my opinion, the benefit system is structured in such a way that incentivizes people to either engage in benefit fraud or otherwise behave in a negative way that leads to their long-term unemployment.
Well, I mean, we've discussed it a lot recently with some of the changes to the budget. It was coming out about all of the various taxes that people are subject to, and the number that was being bandied about was that the average working family, to be able to earn as much as a two-parent family where neither of them were at work, and they had three children, the working family would need to earn £71,000 per year to have the same take-home pay. And I see it as that's a huge incentive to not work and take advantage of the system. Even outside of whatever benefits may be going to foreigners, even within if it was only British people, that's still a massive disincentive for people to be productive.
Yeah, it's disgusting. And it's also quite sad, because I know lots of young people who are on universal credit and they're getting like £300 a month to live off, and they live with their parents. And it's really sad that we have created such a society whereby it's not only improbable to work, but it's also improbable to get off the benefit system. Because the way I've discussed this with other people, if you're going for a job and you're on benefits, you can't really it can be quite difficult to start a full-time job because of all your benefits being withdrawn and things like that. I would think that
I've seen it happen to people myself. They go, well, it's not actually worth it for me to go into work.
Yeah, it's sad. And I think, as relates to the deportations angle, I would like to see in the future from an organization like Restore Britain or Restore Britain itself to have some very well thought out policy proposals on how to create a helpful and effective social safety net for British people that has a bounce in it. Like, for example, I've got a friend who's an expert gymnast, and they have these bouncy like nets which spring you back up when you fall. I mean, that's what the social safety net should be.
Yeah, it helps you get back onto your feet. Yeah, and well, the interesting thing that you said there, in the book you talk about how lots of legislation, because the MPs, I mean, you don't have to be an expert on any of this to be an MP. No. You just need to get into a party or be an independent and get voted in.
Yeah.
So a lot of the legislation is written up by NGOs and quangos. So an organisation like Restore Britain could act, if they dedicated their time to very productive matters like that, they could act as an organization that has all of these proposals drafted and written up in time for, in 2029, for instance, potentially a reform government, if reform was serious. But here's where you come into some of the other problems that we've already been discussing. Given their very public feuding and the issues that happened at the beginning of this year, you would then have to hope that Nigel Farage, Rupert Lowe, Zia Yusuf can put their prior animosity aside to be able to work together as in coordination with one another. So there you run into some of the other problems that we've been speaking about, the kind of media demagoguery that infects the whole movement, frankly.
Yes, this... Even if Restore Britain end up drafting policy proposals that are very good, that don't get put into practice by a reform government or any government in the future, in the near future anyway, it's still a benefit having the right that is able to draft policy and has a clear policy framework. Because as far as I'm aware, the right that's further to the right than the Conservatives within Britain hasn't really had a clear set of policies that are ready to implement. It's been general, oh, we want to do this, we want to increase government spending, we want to...
In a lot of cases, it's more of a philosophical movement.
Yeah.
Than it is a practical than it is practical.
Yes. And I would rather put the horse before the cart in that sense and go, okay, well, this is what we're ready to implement and we want to implement. How do we get it implemented? Because I've worked on some minor level political campaigns that have been on, certainly for local government, on policy and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've noticed with the way that policy gets implemented is they take a bit of this, they take a bit of that. And it'd be interesting for someone like Restore, I would think that it's a very good idea to come up with self-contained policies that are written in such a way that if they were implemented, they're written in such a way that that they would work in a vacuum in of itself. Because lots of grandiose policy proposals that I can think of are dependent on all aspects of government working together to enable that policy goal to be achieved. Whereas if someone like Restore Britain took an area of policy and thought, okay, how do we make this policy achieve our goals directly and indirectly, but also so that it will work in a freestanding way that isn't dependent on other government departments. Given the absolute state of the British administrative state, that's going to be a very difficult job.
Well, at the very least, I do hope that we can start moving in positive directions with all of this. Is there anything else from the book that you would like to very briefly discuss before we finish?
Not really.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you very, very much for your time, Henry. Where can people pick up your book, Lawfare, A Practical Guide?
Right. You can pick it up off the Imperium Press website. You can also pick it up in an electronic format on Amazon, I believe, and you can also get it as a hard copy from Amazon. Depending on where you are, it might be easier for you to get it from Amazon, but if you can, please get it from Imperium Press, because that supports our publishers.
And it doesn't give a cut to Amazon.
Yes.
And what else can people find in here that they haven't heard us discuss today?
Well, there's the speech laws, there's the role of legislating from the bench, there's also my conclusion to the, which has a more practical outlook. I think we've discussed most of it, but there's a lot of case studies and detailed explanations in the book, because that's what I'm like.
Yes, it's like you say, it's dry, it's presented in a very dry way, but if you want to have a better foundation, a better footing for everything that will actually need to be practically done to organise an effective movement, you need to know all of this stuff. So I'd say it's well worth picking up a copy. And where can people find you on social media and Substack?
I'm on X, and it's @LawReading on X, and you can also find me on Substack, which is the Reaction Reading Law Substack.
Well, thank you very, very much for joining us today, Henry. It's been a pleasure. And thank you for watching this. Please take care.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.